It was really the Born to Run song that suddenly invigorated us. We just had, all of us really knew that Bruce Springsteen could be one of the biggest artists. You know, it would be an artist that we could really hang our hat on.
Oh, how many people have claimed to have found and broken Bruce Springsteen over the years. Well, he's one who can do it with some authority. That's the voice of John Gorman, longtime program director at WMMS in Cleveland. From the 70s, I think 73 to be exact, until the early to mid 80s, John oversaw one of the best stations in the country, WMMS. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I'm your host, Rob Bob, and it's good to have you listening. Thank you. Okay, I know it's been a while since I posted a new podcast, but we're back at it. We're back to a more regular schedule, so thank you for your patience. I was reminded on more than one occasion by regular listeners that I had not posted in a while, so here we are. And it's actually going to be part one of a two-part series with John Gorman. He was gracious enough to take a lot of time to speak with me about his years at WMMS, which included, in addition to really being one of the stations to break Bruce Springsteen, they were at the forefront of U2. They were personality driven with people like Denny Sanders and Kid Leo. And it was just a great station. I remember, and I think I'll talk to him a little bit about this. When I was at college at Notre Dame, go Irish, in 1987, I was a freshman and I met Tom Biafore, who had spent some time in the Cleveland area. And we would go back and forth on what station was better. Was it the Loop in Chicago, which I preferred, or WMMS in Cleveland, which he preferred? He says, man, you're going to hear Kid Leo, and he'll be nothing compared to this guy named Bobby Scafish. So as we did back in the day, and you younger listeners probably can't really appreciate this, but we would get air check tapes. So I knew someone who lived in the Cleveland area, and she was going home for the weekend. I gave her a blank cassette. Yes, a cassette tape. And I said, would you please just stick it in your boombox and record WMMS for, you know, 45 minutes each side and bring it back. And I still have it to this day. Don't listen to it much. Don't know how good the quality of the tape is anymore, but I had my sample of Kid Leo and WMMS. And John Gorman was there for a front row seat directing all of it. He'll share those stories with us. But before we get to our interview, I want to say thanks to John's publisher, Gray & Company. We are going to give away a copy or two of John's book called The Buzzard. For those of you unfamiliar with the character, the logo, the buzzard, you'll learn more about it. But all you have to do, we'll probably give away about two or three copies to the first listeners to email me at rockconversations@gmail.com. Got it? rockconversations@gmail.com. So without further ado, let's get to our rock conversation with John Gorman.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
So I want to start, normally I don't do this, but I want to start by reading a paragraph from your book because I think it sets the scene so well. You arrived in Cleveland in 1973, which wasn't really the heyday of economic development for the city. And you wrote, one of your first objectives became making WMMS the Cleveland cheerleader for the next generation. While other media played up gloom and doom, we would champion Cleveland as a city rebuilt on rock and roll, a memorable place to have fun and party, a city with immense potential and the best rock audience on the planet. We would turn every Cleveland liability into an asset. What a vision. I mean, and what a time for you to kind of arrive and have the ability to have that vision. It's almost ironic that while the city was struggling and others were playing up the gloom and doom, you saw the opportunity to say, hey, this is Cleveland and Cleveland rocks.
Well, I came to Cleveland. I'd been to Cleveland one other time, and that was to visit Denny Sanders, who I worked with in Boston. He had gotten a job at MMS a few months earlier. I had no idea I was going to be working in Cleveland a year later, but I visited Denny in Cleveland. And I found the city not this doom and gloom city. Now, granted, it was it was summertime, but I looked, I saw it had a great lakefront, undeveloped. The people were nice, but everywhere when I first moved to Cleveland, You know, I'm getting settled, you know, finding a place to live and just the basics of life when you move into a new city. And they'd hear my Boston accent. And they'd say, "You're not from here." And I said, "No, I just moved from Boston." And I'd always get the same thing. "Why did you move here?" As if this was the absolute worst place in the world that I could possibly live. And I'd say, "Well, it's, you know, I think this is a pretty nice city." And then I'd be told all the reasons why the city was terrible. You know, the river caught on fire, the mayor's hair caught on fire, but not at the same time. The people, you know, Fortune 500 companies were leaving Cleveland in droves. I never heard anything good about Cleveland from the people who lived here. And, you know, Denny was my reference. We had worked together in Boston, and now we're working in Cleveland. So I'm asking him, I'm saying, "What is it about this town? Everybody hates living here." And, you know, he gave me some of the background and so on and so forth. And I started doing research into it. And I started looking at it saying, you know, there's such potential here. And also there was a lot of potential in the format itself. Because, you know, it was called progressive rock back then, album rock.
Sure, yep.
And then it became AOR and all that. But it was a new format that played, instead of playing a limited number of songs from small records with big holes, you're now playing big records with small holes and you're playing multiple tracks off them. So it's a new format. And initially when the format was started, you know, both in New York with WOR-FM and later WNEW, and in San Francisco with KMPX and then later KSAN, they were starting from a different ground zero. They were looking at, it was the first generation where they're saying, well, the audience for rock and roll, they don't stop listening after they get out of high school. They're still listening to music in college. They're listening to some different music, but they haven't given up the music they listened to back then. And you, in the early days, you had you know, artists like Paul Butterfield and the Blues Project, and you know, Bob Dylan was known for, you know, the only artist probably known for album cuts, you know, prior to this format, was you'd hear Beatles cuts on, and you hear Rolling Stone album cuts, and you'd hear, you know, some Bob Dylan cuts. That was it. But here's a format now that's playing albums and playing artists that have not been played on Top 40. The only difference that I looked at is we are a sequel to Top 40. Our audience has grown up with Top 40. Instead of looking at our audience as being 25 plus, I wanted to push it back. I said, let's look at our audience as the kid in high school that now is thinking of college. You know, that suddenly, you know, you're becoming an adult. You realize you realize your life is about to change.
Oh yeah.
So that was the audience we wanted to have. That suddenly it's not the moon and June and the hit records. You want a soundtrack to your life. And so that's how we really approached building WMRS, was the sequel to Top 40 Radio. We in our early days, we would play some of the Top 40 hits that happened, you know, the rock hits that happened before album rock radio. So we took a different approach, and it was almost like it was like losing your virginity. You know, you suddenly, you can't take it back. You know, once you start discovering the artists that we're playing, these new artists and their long songs, and at the same time you discovered smoking pot, and you just, you know, your life is changing. The way you're listening to music is changing. On top of that, there was also the birth of you had stereo systems, you know, component systems that you could put together. So the way you're listening to music, the way you're absorbing it is different. On top of that, it's FM, it's stereo. It's a different way of, it's an unknown. Most cars didn't have stereo FM radios. They had AM. So in the early days, we were pushing, you know, going out and getting installing an FM converter in your dashboard.
I had one of those, incidentally, in my 1971 Volkswagen Super Beetle.
Yep. And that was another, that was like getting the third base. That was not virginity, but that was,
you know. Oh yeah. I mean that, you know,
so, I mean, that was like
the car went from here to here. If you can envision it.
Exactly.
So it wasn't a Chickmobile, but it still worked.
Exactly. Well, and they were Chickmobiles to Peter. Hey, what's that music you're playing? But, you know, nonetheless, in our early days, we used to do promotions every week, with stores that would go, that you could drive in and get your FM radio installed, your FM converter. So, you know, everything that we were doing, it was based on, we're a new radio station on a new platform, and we're playing all this new music, and our disc jockeys aren't screaming at you, here's the latest hits from the Beatles and all. You know, it was a more adult approach to playing music, but it still had the energy and the excitement. What I didn't like about the earlier album rock stations is it was almost like a classical music delivery where everybody's whispering.
Yeah, there is kind of that element from that day.
Yeah.
And those stations. Yep.
And I didn't like that. I, you know, if you're playing rock and roll, be rock and roll. You know, you have to be, you have to excite your audience. So, you know, one of the things that I really pushed on doing was that we sort of have this up tempo feel, and we wanted to attract as much of an audience as we could by being familiar enough to playing enough of the music that they know, and then in between those songs, here's something you probably haven't heard before you may like, and at the same time, we were very conscious of we needed a national profile. Cleveland had a terrible reputation. You know, you heard the city Cleveland and you thought something even worse than Gary, Indiana. You know, you kept hearing, everybody knew the river caught on fire.
You were the mistake by the lake, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Without question.
Exactly.
And I want to throw in before I forget that my wife and I went to Cleveland about 4 or 5 years ago. And we just spent a night there. I went to the Rock and Roll Hall, walked around. We thought it was a great city, you know, still under a little regentrification.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we went with an open mind and left with great memories. So yeah. It's, you know, it certainly has evolved over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't as bad as you thought it could be.
That is true. That is true.
And the city now has really, it's completely changed. And since in the last 4 years, I mean, the city's had some enormous growth, but we also have new leadership. We have younger people now running the city, and they're doing a better job.
Let's talk about some of the personalities. You're kind of an outlier here on our podcast, because generally I feature rock critics, rock authors, and DJs. I think you said once that your voice was better left off the air, and instead you cultivated some of the greatest personalities at MMS. I want to talk about a couple of them. Donna Helper is someone we interviewed a while back. She discovered Rush, I think really her claim to fame.
Yeah.
I would say, and I'd like your, I think you hired her sight unseen and you had been told about her ahead of time. And to paraphrase Lou Grant, I think she still has some spunk left in her.
No, well, Donna was an interesting hire. You know, when I got the job at MMS, the first thing I had to do, you know, I learn the lay of the land, but also in staffing the station, I had to at least find people I knew about. And, you know, when I was living in Boston, Donna Halper was actually the music director and a personality on a station called WCAS. It was an AM station, but it was a folk music format. And the CAS stood for Cambridge, Arlington, and Somerville, three immediate suburbs surrounding Boston. And, you know, think about it. There aren't many cities in the country outside of a Boston, maybe a San Francisco, where you could have a folk music format. But I was very impressed with the way that format was designed. And I wanted to get a music director on WMMS that really had connections and finding new music and finding music that isn't necessarily what was being promoted to the station. One of the things that I knew right from the beginning with MMS is we have the liabilities. Now, how do we turn these liabilities into assets? One is, how do we make Cleveland more important and probably very important to the rest of the music industry and to the rest of the world? And first thing I thought of is, we have to break music. We have to show that we're an influence. And in my early months in Cleveland, and when I knew I was coming here, I really researched Cleveland back and forth. And Cleveland was probably the most unusual city to have a radio station in, because it's really three, actually I could say it's four different markets in one. And every market, especially back in those days, it's more homogenized now since deregulation. But there used to be a time when you could tell what city you're in by turning on the radio. And every city had its own quirks. They had their own hits. They had their own style of music and all that. Everybody's playing probably the same top 10 songs, but everything else may be a little different. The flavor is a little different.
Sure, absolutely.
And so I was, when I looked at Cleveland, it was an unusual city. You couldn't get from the west side of Cleveland to the east side of Cleveland. Everything dead-ended in downtown. And by dead-ended, I mean, there was not a single interstate. Actually, there was one interstate that you could leave Cleveland and go south. I-77 was only 3 miles long leaving from Cleveland. Then you had to get off on a suburb and drive on a separate road to get back on I-77. So there wasn't a direct route from Cleveland to Akron. There wasn't a direct route from the east side to the west side of Cleveland. There was a route from Cleveland downtown to the southern suburbs, but that was it. So you couldn't get there from here. It was a very frustrating city.
Almost sounds like the inspiration for an R.E.M. song.
Oh, exactly.
Can't get there from here, right?
Yeah.
And remember what I told you about my wife? Remember I said my wife and I really enjoyed Cleveland? Right. There's one caveat to that comment. I got totally lost leaving the city. I know things have changed and it's, not quite the cluster it once was, but I still got all turned around. And generally, yeah, I have a decent sense of direction. I digress. Go ahead.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. The roads they built, by the time they finished the interstates, it's still a mess, but it's nowhere near what it was back in the 70s and when I first came. But
you talk about the breaking bands, discovering new artists. It's a perfect segue. We talked about Donna kind of finding, not kind of, she found Rush through her contacts. I think one of the biggest discoveries, if you will, I think it's fair to say, would be Bruce Springsteen. MMS was one of the early backers of Springsteen. Tell us how that relationship came about, because I understand that Kid Leo had a lot to do with it and others as well.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm about to go, you gave me a perfect segue there. This east and west, the fact that people who lived on the east side never went to the west side. I knew more people on the east side had been to New York than had been to the west side of Cleveland. I knew more people in the west side of Cleveland that had been to Chicago and had never been to the east side of Cleveland.
Interesting.
And what happened is the two regions of Cleveland, the east and west side, the general greater Cleveland area, developed different musical tastes. The east side was, depending on what part of the east side, it was either very sophisticated, where they got really all into album rock. And then as you went up Lake Erie and the suburbs that are fronting Lake Erie, they were stuck in the British invasion. They loved pop music. That's where the Raspberries came from. And they loved that kind of music. You go to the west side of Cleveland and it was more of a general rock and roll. They weren't so much into the album artists as they were just generally rock and roll. Then you go to Akron, and Kent is part of the Akron market. You get into some very interesting music. You get into a lot of deep musicians who are really sophisticated in their craft. Great guitarists, great drummers, great bass players and all that. And also, the Akron market was very, very left of center. So when we were putting the station together and finding artists to break, Bruce Springsteen being one of them, we had to find artists that we felt, okay, this artist is going to break on this side of town. This artist is going to break on this side of town. This artist is going to break out in Akron. how can we then absorb them into one station? Because we're programming to three different markets. And so taking a Bruce Springsteen or taking a Roxy Music, we would put the artist on the air. We would really talk about the music we're playing. You know, with Bruce Springsteen, it was funny, you know, Leo really led the cause to break Bruce Springsteen. And it was kind of funny because in the very beginning, Leo was much more of a Mata Hoople, New York Dolls, you know, that kind of music, the current music that was happening that was different than the progressive music of the 70s, of the 60s rather. So, you know, Leo's taste originally was much more left of center. And Bruce Springsteen, in the beginning, Leo didn't get it. He said, the guy said, like, Bob Dylan. And Leo hated Bob Dylan.
Oh, you know? Okay.
So, you know, when he first heard Springsteen, he's hearing these, you know, long stories and all that. And it's like, he doesn't have the time for that. He's into the shorter songs. But as time went on, Leo was listening to Springsteen. And actually, it really took the Born to Run. It was just before the Born to Run album came out. We knew there was something there with Springsteen. We knew that he actually, it was like a couple of people on the staff really got into Springsteen before Leo did. And it made, but see, we spent a lot of time talking about music and tuning each other to music. So Leo started listening to Springsteen saying, you know something? I started listening to lyrics. This guy has something to say. And then the label came in, Columbia, and we were becoming, by that time, we were becoming that market that's breaking music. So the New York people came in, they said, we want you to hear this new, you know, it's Bruce Springsteen's and us, we have two albums by and this and that. And they play us Born to Run. And they didn't play us the Born to Run that ended up on the album. They played the version of Born to Run that had strings and had a female chorus. And it really sounded like a Phil Spector production. And Leo and I listening to this song Born to Run for the first time, and I'm looking at the look of Leo's face, and Leo loved Phil Spector stuff, and he's saying, "God, you know, this is like Phil Spector. This is like Be My Baby. This is an anthem. This is great. I love it." And you know, we all listened to it, and we also decided, "Hey, this song is good enough that it has to launch the weekend." You know, this is like something like it's 5 o'clock, you know, the factories are closed, everything, time it's born, it's baby time, it's Born to Run. And, excuse me, it was really the Born to Run song that suddenly invigorated us to let's behind this art. This is an artist we break. We just had, all of us really knew that Bruce Springsteen could be one of the biggest artists. You know, it would be an artist that we could really hang our hat on. So we really got behind it. We went back to the first two albums, and this is still months before the Born to Run album came out. So we had really made Springsteen a household name before the Born to Run album came out. So, you know, and when that album came out, it was like everybody was waiting for it. And and part of that is the fact that, you know, we had, you know, Leo getting behind Springsteen, you know, Denny getting behind, everybody who was on the air, I encouraged everybody, if you really like a song, I told the labels, I want all of our air staff to be serviced because they may hear something that I don't hear. And I said, I want, you know, and the way I was positioning MMS is, I want a station where everybody knows the personalities, and the personalities all have the power to break music. So that went back. Breaking Springsteen was part of the goal we had to be important to the rest of the world and important to the music industry, that we break new music. And at the same time we're breaking Bruce Springsteen, we were also playing Mata Hoople, we were playing Roxy Music, we were playing a lot of other acts that weren't getting played many on basic AOR stations.
Well, my first introduction to MMS was actually when I was in college.
I arrived in 1987 on campus, went to work for the local radio station. And there was a senior working there by the name of Tom Biafor. And you know how, if you recall, you know, when you're young, especially when you're a freshman, you know it all, right? And no one's going to tell you differently. And that's how I was, this brazen freshman. And we got talking about radio. I said, yeah, God, I love the Loop. I said, Bobby Scafish, an afternoon drive or early evening, depending on, you know, where Steve and Gary were. He's great. He said, no. Now, I've never even heard Scafish, but there's no way he can stand up to Kid Leo. And I'm like, who the heck is this Kid Leo? Oh, he works on MMS in Cleveland. So, you know, we did back in those days, geeks like me, we find someone who lives in Cleveland. Say, hey, you going home for the weekend to see your parents?
Yeah.
It's a cassette. Stick this in your boombox. Hit record. You know, make sure you get the right station. So, you know, she was able to capture that Friday afternoon. And let me think. I'm going from memory. You'll be able to correct me if I have it wrong. So it's 87. I think you went Born to Run, Cleveland Rocks, and then Friday on My Mind.
Yes.
Is that right? Easy Beats. Okay. And what a way. And I was like,
yeah, it was Friday in My Mind, then Cleveland Rocks. And in before that, there was a part, there was another ingredient that lasted for a few years. We had a person by the name of Murray Saul.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he would bring in the weekend. It would start with Born to Run. Then Murray would come on and it would be, excuse me, a 6 minute about the slave driver and the factories are closed and get out there. I mean, it was very cutting edge. And what made Murray popular is the fact that Murray was late 40s, early 50s. In fact, he has 50th birthday on MMS. Now, in those days, when you back look at, you know, the 73, 74, 75, there was a real generation gap. You know, if you were a certain age, you know, I mean, it was the Vietnam War, everything was going, but there was a big generation gap. So for WMS to have a 50-year-old guy who's bald and, you know, looks like everybody's father coming on the air talking about Roll Another Tuna, which was a way of, you know, roll another joint, and enough disguise. I mean, it was actually like within this get down, it was telling everybody the available pot in town and how good it was and everything else, but it was all disguised. And we had all of these, you know, names for substances and all of that. And Born to Run was part of that kickoff. It was Born to Run, Murray, then, you know, Friday My Mind, then Cleveland Rocks. Cleveland Rocks, which came a little later because that didn't come out until, I forget. But we were already doing what we used to call the Holy Trinity. You know, the Bruce Springsteen, sure, yep. Murray, and Earthquakes, Friday My Mind. But that was a signature. That's how we brought in the weekend.
Now, I want to go back to something you said. They brought in a different version of Born to Run. Did you ever play that version or did you wait till the album came out? Okay.
Actually, we played that version until the album came out. And then we saw the album had a different version. We switched to the album version, which is what the label wanted. But, you know, we pocketed the other version. I have the original version.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Up until a few months ago, I was doing an online station. It was actually for 7 years. I was doing this online station called OhWow.radio. And we brought back, I have the old Murray's. We brought back that whole Friday in My Mind and all of that. And I ended up putting in that old Born to Run, the original Phil Spector, you know, with the strings and all that.
Yeah.
And that was blowing people's mind because, like, I remember that version.
One last Springsteen story and we can move on. Although I do love Springsteen, so I don't want to rush it too much. But oddly enough, and you can tell the story better, there was a connection with Tim Russert. Many people remember him from Meet the Press and NBC News, Election Night 2000, and his little marker board. But he was at John Carroll, if I'm not mistaken, maybe in law school at the time, and helped promote concerts. So take us from there. You pick up on the story. What was the connection with Russert, Springsteen, and MMS?
Yeah, I believe this was the second time Bruce Springsteen played in something other than a club in Cleveland. But nonetheless, it was John Carroll was bringing Bruce Springsteen to town. It was, I forget the year, But Russet was no, Russet had gone to John Carroll, excuse me, and I believe he left John Carroll, but he was still, yeah, he's trying to pay his way through college.
Mm-hmm.
And so he put together a Bruce Springsteen concert, booked Bruce Springsteen for a concert for John Carroll University, which is in the Near East Side of Cleveland. And it was basically to, you know, for him to make some money. And he ended up, he wasn't the person that we knew from Meet the Press then. He was still, you know, in law school. And I don't believe he was going to John Carroll at the time, but nonetheless, he was putting this concert on with Bruce Springsteen. And so he was calling me quite often as far as, you know, we were a co-sponsor because we could, you know, we could promote it. And plus I wanted my call letters on it. Anytime I could get my call letters on something, I did. And I remember they had to, there was some kind of a schedule. They all these posters printed up all over town. And then they had to, Springsteen had to change the date. There was some kind of a schedule conflict. And I just remember, you know, Russet, you know, calling constantly about, hey, can we change the schedule? Do you think people are going to know? What do you think we should do with the posters? I said, why don't you just, you know, print up, you know, keep the poster, just put a new date on it, you know, get something printed up and slap the new date on. But Tim was involved with that concert. And I guess the story goes that years later, he ran into Springsteen in New York at a restaurant and told him the story. And Springsteen said back to him, that sounds like one of my songs.
Oh, nice, nice. We are talking with John Gorman. Before I forget, and we'll do it again at the end, I want to plug your book, The Buzzard, which is available on, I think, Amazon and through your publisher as well. Great,
yeah,
publishing,
pretty much,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic book. It you know, it's not easy to convey the energy sometimes in words, but you certainly did it throughout the book. It was a really quick read. And that's certainly a compliment to your writing style.
Well, thank you. Well, actually, the story about it is I had a programming assistant for years, Rhonda Kiefer, and I'm on a, you know, when you're on a creative end, you're missing something. I used to say it's about air personalities. You know, if you have somebody that is this good here, it's like the scales of justice. Well, something is missing from here. So I'm not a very good organized person, but I'm very good at creating things. And Rhonda was the opposite. She was very good at taking what I was doing and filing it in the proper way. And one of the things that she did was she saved every memo, every file, everything that happened at the station, I always would write down. And every memo I'd save. What she did is she had them filed in two ways, one chronologically and the other according to subject. And she did that for the entire time that I was at MMS. So my entire history was in this file cabinet. And when it came time to leave MMS, I packed up these files and took them with me. I had no idea what to do with them. And I kept telling Ron, they said, you know, you ought to take these files and you ought to write a book. You know, you ought to do something. She was no, no, no. Then finally, I got approached by a publisher, Gray and Company, and they said, could you write the MMS book? And I said, well, you know, I don't know. I've never written a book before, but, you know, I can try. But what really saved me was the fact that I had the whole history of the station in chronological order and just about everything that happened at that station. So when I started the project, I kept every day I was writing and a few pages. When it was finished, I had 1,500 pages.
Oh boy!
Because a lot happened in 13 years at that station.
Yeah.
When I was there. And I had to now take these you know 1,500 pages and reduce them down to at the most 300 pages, and. There was a person named Tom Ferrin, who was the TV radio editor of the Plain Dealer at the time. And I wasn't sure, you know, I you know, when I told the publisher I'm finished, but it's 1500 pages, well, you got to get it down to this amount. I could only get it down at the most, because I was too close to it, to like 600, 700 pages. And the good thing about Tom Fearn being the radio and TV editor for The Plain Dealer is he was not in Cleveland. He was a Cleveland native, but he was not in Cleveland for the entire time that WMMS was on the air. Those 13 years, he went to Harvard. He worked at other newspapers, and he ended up getting the Plain Dealer job, but it was after I had left WMMS. So he was the ideal person to really edit what I couldn't edit, because he wasn't here, but he was familiar with Cleveland, and he was able to, you know, really slice it down to the right size. So I have to give Tom credit for editing it down to, and that was a monumental task, believe me. The stories that weren't told were interesting too, but, you know, we had to draw the line somewhere.
Maybe there can be a sequel.
Well, I always thought about it, but then again, when I look back at that book, it kind of tells, you know,
it encompasses your time there very well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've been approached a couple of times, and I do have in my mind, if I ever write the other book, it'll be called Buzzard Uncensored. If I ever write it, I don't know.
There's so much to discuss, and maybe we can pick it up on another time. But in the few minutes we have left, I'd do some rapid fire here. Not surprisingly, you were a station, WMMS was a station that backed U2 early on.
Yes.
Tell me about this conversation you had with Bono about religion.
Well, you know, I always, there are certain times in your life that, you know, they become these benchmarks. And, you know, I was really a U2 fan. I'm half Irish, but nonetheless, you know, when U2 first came out, the first time they ever headlined a club or headlined anything in America was in Cleveland. They were initially on a tour with a band called Beruga Bandit from Detroit. And it was a club tour, and they were the opening act. And I went, and they had an opening date, and the Agora was a club that we had. It was a club that could seat about 900 to 1,000, which was probably over the fire limit, but that's life. That's rock and roll. But U2 had an open date, and I talked to Buddy Maple, who was booking the Agora, and I said, you ought to get this band in. You know, we're playing, it was New Year's Day, and that was the first album. I said, I think this band is going to be something. And said, you know, it's an act we're playing. So he booked them on an off day that they went on the tour. And they were a headline band. I went to see them. And my God, were they awful.
Really?
Looking at this band. Well, they were very sloppy. They were young and all that. But I kept looking at the lead singer. And I kept looking at the guitarist, but especially the lead singer, especially Bono. And he had this determined look on his face, and it really captivated me. I'm listening to this band saying, you know, as much as they're sloppy and out of tune and all of that, there is something there. I think this band is going to be something. So, you know, in subsequent time, I told the Agora, and you know, it we pushed it so hard that the concert sold out. And I just said to Buddy, and Buddy agreed, that Buddy Maver at the Agora, anytime this band is available in the States, book them. And he booked them from another club tour and this and that. And we did a live broadcast with them as well. And it wasn't the best, you know, they were still finding their way. But nonetheless, when they finally got booked for the war tour, where they were now playing small halls, I said, I want to get this band down to the station. I really want, because I, you know, I said, I really think there's something there with the band. And they came in, and Bono was like no other rock person I ever met. He was very sophisticated. He was down. He was very protective of U2, the image. He was very serious with everything he wrote. So we start talking, and we end up spending the entire afternoon together. And then after the concert that night, we ended up spending that much more time. And we really got into a heavy conversation about religion, about the Catholic Church and the Protestant, because it turns out his father was Catholic, his mother was Protestant. And that wasn't easy in Ireland for him growing up because of that whole problem with Northern Ireland.
No, I think that would be an understatement. Yeah, so that wasn't easy. Yeah.
So, I mean, we start talking about the history of religion. And, you know, after it was over, I just kept saying, you know, this is the most interesting conversation I've had with a rock star or somebody who's in rock and roll in my life, because we hardly talked about music.
That's absolutely fascinating. I want
to
do one more.
And I just found to be such a brilliant person. I mean, he, you know, you could tell this is before he was, you know, out to save the world. But he was the guy who really, truly wanted to save the world. I mean, what he was doing in his charities, it's 100% sincere. It did come from his heart.
And on that note, a pretty good one at that, we wrap up the first part of our interview with John Gorman, formerly of WMMS in Cleveland. Isn't that proof that Cleveland rocks? I think so. Thanks for joining us on Rock Conversations. Our next episode will be part 2 with John Gorman.